This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the leaf-covered back corner of the Reading Envy Pub.
Hello, Scott.
Hello, Jenny. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Who did you bring with you today?
Well, I had so much fun with Jean last time on our last episode that she's back again.
All right.
Hi, I'm here.
Hello, Jean.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Well, good.
And I heard that you're doing well as well.
I am also doing well. You bet. But
I'm not.
I'm not wearing a costume.
Oh.
I guess that's the difference between real life and virtual life.
Second life, yeah. Well, let's talk about books.
Let's talk about
books. How about you go first, Jenny?
All right. Well, I've been taking a creative nonfiction class this semester, and I've been reading a lot of nonfiction. And the funny thing is that this isn't why I picked the book that I've brought. It is The Far Away Nearby by Rebecca Solnit. And I'm in this group in Goodreads where we pick a different country every year and read a bunch of books about it. And this year we're in Iceland. And this book has a little tiny bit about Iceland. It's not really about Iceland. It's about apricots and mothers and I don't know, lots of things like that. Storytelling. But it's definitely in that kind of style, that creative nonfiction style. So I really enjoyed it. The writing is beautiful. I was paying more attention, I guess, to how it was written. It's also just kind of about dealing with family and like when there's illness in the family, like the mother is losing her memory and things like that. So it kind of gets interwoven. And the story starts and ends with apricots. So it kind of like you go up the mountain and then back down the mountain and the same topics or into a book and back out of the book, however you want to look at it.
Hmm. So is it, you're saying it's a story and, or is it a collection of essays?
Both.
Both.
I mean, it's, they're her own personal experiences.
Oh, cool.
But they're not necessarily told in a linear order.
Okay.
It's very reflective. So I thought I would read a little bit from almost exactly in the middle when she actually does get to Iceland. So you can kind of get a sense of the writing.
Cool.
What's your story? There are so many ways to tell it. When the near capsized like a ship, the far swept me up. I flew over the untrammeled lands of the subarctic and then across the sea. From the air, Iceland looked like a high relief puzzle of dark stone and pale vegetation and blue water. It was as strange as another planet. In the calm, sparsely populated airport, Frida and the regal Clara were waiting with a big car to bring me and my bundles of books and warm clothes past long miles of knife-edged lava upholstered in thick moss to the city of Reykjavik. In the city, I wandered dazed and jet-lagged and still convalescent and contemplated pale people, a stuffed two-headed lamb in a store window, and the view north across the blue waters of the wide fjord to the sharp mountains, still clad in snow. I guess I'll stop there.
Jenny, that sounds like your dream vacation.
Oh my gosh. I want to go to Iceland so bad.
With all the books too?
Oh man. And so many people in Iceland love to read. They have a very high literacy rate. I think it's like 100%.
Wow.
And she actually gets to go there to go to the Library of Water. So she had some kind of fellowship where she got to go to the Library of Water every day and write there and talk to other writers that were there. It was amazing. This building, and it's a beautiful building, and it's on top of a hill. And then inside there are these glass tubes, and in each glass tube is a part of a glacier that's melted. I don't know.
Well.
Fascinating.
That does sound cool.
Yeah. And another thing I wrote a lot about down is storytelling. And let me read just a little tiny bit about her mother, because it made me laugh. Like many elderly people, she was convinced that rather than her losing things, others were stealing them. Irons, purses, keys, laundry, money. And she lost more things by hiding them from these fictitious characters who helped conceal her real problems. The world of her imagination filled up with thieves and prowlers, though she'd never actually been the victim of a crime in that nice neighborhood 20 miles north of the city.
Yeah, I like the writing style. That's nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then I will say one more thing about this writer. Have you heard the term mansplaining?
Yes.
Okay.
Experienced mansplaining.
Yes, I have too. Well, it all came about, I guess, because of an essay that she wrote. She didn't come up with the term, but someone came up with it kind of as a response to what she had said. It's called Men Explain Things to Me. And so,
okay, what is mansplaining? I'm sure I'm not guilty of it, but.
Well, Gene, do you want to take a crack at what mansplaining?
Mansplaining is when a man feels the need to explain something to a woman like she's stupid.
Mm.
Well, let me explain this to you guys. No, is it like that?
It's very much.
It's something that many women experience on a pretty regular basis.
Oh, shoot. Well, I apologize to both of you for males everywhere.
We'll take it.
I checked it before you could even get the words out of your mouth.
Let us explain this to you.
Oh, I love it. That's pretty cool. Yeah, my image of Iceland now is it's in there from Walter Mitty. Did you guys see that movie?
Yes.
Yeah. It was pretty. The movie wasn't terrific. It was good, but it wasn't great. But Iceland was sure cool.
That was beautiful.
Yeah.
And they filmed the parts that were not set in Iceland in Iceland. Like the Himalayan part and the Greenland part.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
It's all Iceland.
And the big skateboard scene had to have been Iceland, right?
So beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I've rewatched that movie just for the landscape.
Have you? Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty.
Now I want to reread Thurber. I haven't read Thurber in a really long time.
What is Thurber?
He's the guy who wrote Mitty.
Yeah. I didn't know that was the book.
James Thurber. It's a short story, I think.
Illustrator, too.
Yeah, I don't think it was a novel. I think it was a story.
Yeah. I'm writing that down.
Great.
Well, Gene, I'm so curious what book you have brought to talk about today, or the first one.
I brought two books. One is called The Lover by Marguerite Duras. And I picked it up because there's a book club on the campus, the university campus where I work. And I'm not in that book club because I'm in the League of Extraordinary Dorks book club. I met the woman who kind of runs the book club, and I thought, well, okay, I'm curious about this, so I looked at the blog and I started reading some of the entries about the book, because it's not just we had a book club and this was the book. There's information about the author and about the history. And the whole book club is about books that are kind of forgotten classics or the best books you've never read, and they're all supposed to be very short. So I thought, well, I can probably rip through one of these.
Cool.
Anyway, so this book is, it's a memoir of a period of her life, of her childhood. And apparently she's written about it before in several other formats. And there was a film about it. This woman was a writer and a filmmaker. And she is definitely the like your typical stereotype of what a French woman was in the 20th century, the mid 20th century. And so her writing style is kind of like Henri the cat from the YouTube videos. She's just, everything is terrible and depressing. And it actually gets kind of funny. I'm not going to read a part that's funny, though. But anyway, what the book is really focused on is her experience as growing up in Vietnam, because her parents were part of the the people from France who went to live in Vietnam and colonize Vietnam. And so what she did when she was about 15 is she took a lover. And the other part of that is that her lover was Chinese, which I guess was even more socially, among the French, considered more socially inferior even than the Vietnamese. So she kind of did this daring thing for the place and the time. And it seems like it was a really transformative moment in her life. So that's what she was focusing on, and all of the changes that came about in her life because of it. But I'm going to read a bit about what she says about her mother. It's very dramatic, and in some ways to me melodramatic, but it's also really sad. So in this passage, Do is her mother's maid. My mother, my love, her incredible ungainliness, with her cotton stockings darned by Do, in the tropics, she still thinks you have to wear stockings to be a lady. A headmistress, her dreadful shapeless dresses, mended by Do. She's still straight out of her Picardy farm, full of female cousins. Thinks you ought to wear everything till it's worn out, that you have to be deserving. Her shoes. Her shoes are down at the heel. She walks awkwardly, painfully, her hair's drawn back, tight into a bun, like a Chinese woman's. We're ashamed of her. I'm ashamed of her in the street outside the school, when she drives up to the school in her old car. Everyone looks, but she doesn't notice anything, ever. She ought to be locked up, beaten, killed. She looks at me and says, perhaps you'll escape. Day and night, this obsession. It's not that you have to achieve anything. It's that you have to get away from where you are. I mean, it's very sad that she thinks of her mother this way, but it's also just the way it's written is a little bit eye-rolly to me. I'm just like, oh man, why do you have to be so down on her mom like that? Was she really that awful? Maybe she was. At any rate, it just that passage stuck out to me, and of course the last line. So
interesting, yeah.
I can't imagine wearing stockings in the jungle.
Yeah. In the jungle.
Did you know about her before you read the book?
I didn't. I didn't know anything other than what I had briefly read on this blog. And I was fascinated by the idea that she had written about this same event in her life, taking a lover when she was 15, that she'd written about it so many times. And then one of the things I learned is that this book is supposed to be the definitive final story of what happened, that in earlier versions, when her mother and her brothers were still alive, she was not writing the full truth. But even so, in this book, the truth seems really fluid. She kind of goes back and forth. And it's like, did you love your mother? Or did you hate your mother? Was your brother a monster? Or was he your best friend? I mean, she kind of seems to vacillate between these two, between all kinds of extremes. Did you love this person that you met? Or did you hate him? Did you find him repulsive? It's very extreme.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
And you said it was short.
Yeah, it's pretty short. I think I read through it in like a night or two. Mm. And But it was a bit depressing.
Yeah.
So be prepared if you choose to read this book.
Depressing. Right. Hooray.
And yet, when I read about it on the blog, I was still, like, compelled to read it. I was still curious enough
about the story. Oh, yeah.
Like, I thought there would be more about the scandal of it, like, the other people's in her social circle or the other girls in her school. I thought there'd be more about that reaction, but she really shoved that all aside and made it all about what happened within her family with her mother and her brothers and her relationship with the man that she met. So That was my book.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, it sounds good.
You bet.
So Scott.
All right. Well, you both kind of talked about nonfiction memoirs and the book that I have today is based on a fact, but is a novel. I teach a group at a library to fifth, sixth, seventh grade people. And I've got it on Saturday. But the last time that I was there, we got to talking about the Newbery Awards. I realized that every Newbery Award winner that I had read was good. Like The Giver and Island of the Blue Dolphins and The Graveyard Book, which is one of my favorite books. I just love that book. And, so the last time I, was at that group, I said, well, let's pick a book and I'll read it. And they picked one called The One and Only Ivan by Catherine Applegate. Have you guys, either of you heard of this book?
No.
Mm-hmm. It's, I had neither. So it was kind of cool just to pick a book off a list and just read it. So it is a Newbery Award winner, won the award in 2013, and it's about a gorilla named the one and only Ivan. And what makes it kind of unique is that the whole book is told from the gorilla's point of view. It's as if the gorilla is writing the book. So when you look at a typical page, each paragraph is very short and there's a space between the paragraph and the next paragraph. And it's written very simply, as if the gorilla, you know, you're in the gorilla's thoughts the whole time. So, but it makes it really interesting. So I wanted to find just a little part to read. So the gorilla, Ivan, he lives at the Exit 8 Big Top Mall and Video Arcade. And he's in a cage, which he'll describe here. So this is page 6, so it's very close to the beginning. I live in a human habitat called the Exit 8 Big Top Mall and Video Arcade. We are conveniently located off I-95 with shows at 2, 4, and 7, 365 days a year. Mac says that when he answers, Mac says that when he answers the trilling telephone. Mac works here at the mall. He is the boss. I work here too. I am the gorilla. At the Big Top Mall, a creaky music carousel spins all day, and monkeys and parrots live among the merchants. In the middle of the mall is a ring with benches where humans can sit on their rumps while they eat soft pretzels. The floor is covered with sawdust made of dead trees. My domain is at one end of the ring. I live here because I am too much gorilla and not enough human. Stella's domain is next to mine. Stella is an elephant. She and Bob, who is a dog, are my dearest friends. At present, I do not have any gorilla friends. My domain is made of thick glass and rusty metal and rough cement. Stella's domain is made of metal bars. The sun bear's domain is wood. The parrot's is wire mesh. And then it goes, I mean, that's pretty much how the whole book is written. From start to finish, it's just these short paragraphs. And he says some of the most profound things. They're just littered throughout this whole book. You know, you read them and you're like, wow, well that, that's a heck of a nice observation. Another thing that he does is he draws all the time. He has crayons or finger paints and he draws things, and he always says, Mac, who's the owner, he says that Mac can sell this picture for $25, including frame. And he always says, including frame, you know, no matter what. And sometimes he'll draw a big one, and he says, you know, this will be worth $40, including frame. And then at one point, he meets another animal, and the other animal said, well, what's a dollar? And he's like, I don't know. I have no idea. It's just $25. Sounds pretty good to me. So, the book, I don't know. I don't know if this is giving it away too much or not, but you guys tell me, and then I can edit it out if I have to, but it's like it gets very depressing, but in the middle, right? And then it ends up very, very nice. So it's like, it breaks your heart, but then it puts it back together before it's over. Yeah.
I don't think that's giving it away too much.
Well, good.
Actually makes me want to read it.
I highly recommend it. You know, it's a quick read, you know, because of the way that it's written. It's about 300 pages long, but again, you know, a lot of the chapters are just like two or three lines. And each chapter has a chapter heading, you know, like the one that I just read. The chapter heading was The Exit 8 Big Top Mall and Video Arcade. But every chapter, The Littlest Big Top on Earth is the next chapter. And then the next chapter is Gone. And then the next chapter is Artists. he says, here in my domain, I do not have much to do. You can only throw so many meatballs at humans before you get bored. A meatball is made by rolling up dung until it's the size of a small apple and then letting it dry. I always keep a few on hand. For some reason, my visitors never seem to have any. So, I mean, it's like that all the way. But yeah, another worthy award winner. So I'm batting 1,000 on this Newbery list.
Nice. Yeah. Scott, what is the age range for the Newbery?
You know, I think that it's, if I remember right, it's like 8 years old and up.
Okay.
Yeah. Now the Graveyard Book. Have either of you read the Graveyard Book?
Yes.
Yeah. That seems like a little bit older than eight. Not much though. Doesn't it?
Well, I think it's written for. Isn't it written for adults or no? It feels like it could go either way. Yeah.
Well, the Graveyard Book is one of those books I think that people of all ages like. You know, I'm just wondering, you know, if an average 8 year old would be able to read that. I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe I'm wrong. But the Graveyard Book feels older than this book, for sure. This book, yeah could easily be understood and enjoyed by an eight-year-old. But I also really liked it. So what that says about me, I don't know, but thumbs up.
Good book is a good book.
Good book is a good book. That's right. That's right. So I got to pick another Newbery Award winner here soon. I have that group on Saturday.
Is that the award that Bridge to Terabithia won?
Yeah,
I remember it had some kind of. That's okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bridge to Terabithia is on.
Favorite books when
is
I was
it really?
A kid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because I had my own Terabithia in the woods. So.
Oh, that's cool.
You know. That's a heartbreaker of a book. It's the kind where your kid gets mad at you afterwards for making them read it.
Yeah.
Like I am
how
furious.
Could you read this book?
Yeah. The movie was a big hit in my family, but I don't know if any of us read the book. The movie came out not that long ago because the one of the kids from Hunger Games was in that one. So,
yeah,
I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago or something.
I think people got just as mad at the movie. The people hadn't read the book, they weren't expecting.
No, and I hadn't
spoiler,
read the book.
The sad ending.
Yeah, I hadn't read the book. Yeah, that one doesn't put your heart back together. It tears it apart and it steps on it and then it leaves.
Yeah, I mean, it's awful, but I read it in that age of like 9 years old.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Where you see the stuff they see in their heads and I don't know.
Yeah.
You can just create your own
same
world.
Kind of feelings about bullying and about, you know, worrying about your parents and worrying about, you know, loss and then bang.
Yeah.
Sadness.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I went through a phase when I was young where I read all those cancer novels too. So, you know, the like the Lurline McDaniel books. I can't remember the names.
Yeah. Well, cool. So. Well, that's the book. That's what I've
Sounds
got.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
so,
very recent.
Yeah. Very recent. Hmm. Yeah. It was selected almost at random. I mean, we were flipping through the list and then we saw the one and only Ivan. I clicked through and the website for the one and only Ivan has a really nice video. And that was it. That was sold and everybody was like, that's the one. I said, okay, I'll read it.
Actually, so. I have a question about it. Were there any illustrations?
Yeah. Yep. Not a lot, but
like,
some.
But were they like, this is what the gorilla is drawing kind of illustrations?
There was just one that I remember that was the gorilla illustration and they were X's. He was counting days. The rest of them are like black and white, very nice illustrations, but, you know, few and far between, but black and white drawings.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So you have to fill that part in your head, I guess.
I guess so. Yeah. Yeah, because he says, you know, I'm drawing a banana. You know, he often says that, and he says, okay, I've got a yellow crayon. What's yellow? Oh, a banana. Hmm. You know, so he does that, and then he shows the stuff to, like, a girl. He's got a girl that is the daughter of someone who works at this place, who's there all the time. And, you know, so it's like a friendship, but they're not speaking to each other. You know, she always likes his drawings. She shows him her drawings, and she can't always figure out what he's drawing. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that, oh, maybe it doesn't quite look like it, you know?
Yeah.
But then you start to think about, well, what's the nature of art in the first place? Because, you know, he's doing it for himself, and it makes you think about, you know, what the value of art is. And of course, it's very valuable. Yeah.
It's $40 with frame.
With frame, right. I love it. Yep. Highly recommend it.
Great.
Mm-hmm. So what's up next, Jenny?
Well, I hesitated about whether I should talk about this book, but I've never talked about it on Reading Envy. But it is A Constellation of Vital Phenomena by Anthony Mara. Mm-hmm. I've now read this book twice and given it 5 stars both times. It was on a lot of people's best of 2012 lists, I think is how I came across it. Like, I think NPR wrote about it. And then when I read it, I just couldn't believe it. It is this amazing novel about Chechnya. And the chapters move back and forth between 1994 and 2004 and years in between. And at the beginning of every chapter, there's a timeline. And the year that current chapter is set in is in bold. So you always know where you are and when you are.
That's helpful.
Yeah. And honestly, like, I knew that there was violence in Chechnya, but that may be the extent of what I knew. I didn't necessarily have any understanding of it or context for it, even though it's so very recent and possibly still going on. And I know it did go past 2004, at least. And so I'm in this in-person book club where we read books very intentionally set different places around the world. And so this was my first official pick for that book. And so I just had to read it again. One of the things I kept seeing the first time I read it was that people were, like, making comments about how funny it was. And I kept thinking, this is not a funny book. It's Chechnya. People are dying, you know. But the second read, I think I could appreciate it more. There's definitely some humor in there. And the author very intentionally did that because he spent some time there and found that a lot of people in that part of the world deal with trauma and violence by having this really dark humor about everything. So there's some definite interesting characters. And because of the way the story is told, with going back and forth in time, there are some things you would learn a lot earlier if it was told chronologically, but instead you don't really find them out until the end. And I think it makes for a really compelling story. I think I'm just going to read a little bit from the very first 2 pages. I couldn't figure out what to read, so I'm starting at the beginning. And chapter 1 is set in 2004. Hmm. On the morning after the feds burned down her house and took her father, Hava woke from dreams of sea anemones. While the girl dressed, Ahmed, who hadn't slept at all, paced outside the bedroom door, watching the sky brighten on the other side of the window glass. The rising sun had never before made him feel late. When she emerged from the bedroom, looking older than her 8 years, he took her suitcase and she followed him out the front door. He had led the girl to the middle of the street before he raised his eyes to what had been her house. Hava, we should go, he said, but neither moved. The snow softened around their boots as they stared across the street to the wide patch of flattened ash. A few orange embers hissed in pools of gray snow, but all else was char. Not 7 years earlier, Ahmed had helped Daka build an addition so the girl would have a room of her own. And I'll just skip down a little bit. He wound her bright orange scarf around her neck and frowned at the sooty fingerprint on her cheek. He had been awake in bed the previous night when the feds came. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, no.
It's very visual.
Oh, very. Yeah. It's just the whole thing is like that. And so Ahmed takes this girl in and they end up spending a lot of time at a hospital in town where there is one doctor and one nurse for all of these people. Yeah. And they're kind of the central characters. There's a few other people that are neighbors of Ahmed that are really important. One man who refuses to talk to his son because his son is the one that's making, like, turning people in. Yeah. Mm. So, but it's all, you know, like, there are people that you start out not liking and then you start to understand why they're doing what they're doing. And so it's all very complex the way that people are. And I don't know, I'm just blown away by the book.
That sounds really true to life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. And it's his first novel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you're waiting for his next one?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know. I don't know if I really need another one about Chechnya, but yeah, I would read anything that he had.
That's nice. So how often do you reread a book?
Not all that often, I would say. It always happens to me with book clubs because I don't like to pick books I haven't read. For book clubs, yeah, and so I often reread for that.
Yeah, I was just curious, and boy, I'm sorry if I missed if you said it, but why did you reread this one?
For the book club.
For the book club, okay, yep.
Yeah, because I was leading the discussion, and I didn't think I should go from memory.
yeah.
I was really glad I did, though. I feel like I caught more of it this time around.
Yeah, I think there is something about rereading a book. You know, sometimes you reread a book that you really liked a long time ago, and it's like, oh, this really isn't that good. But then at other times you reread something and it just takes on a whole new depth to it. You know, but yeah, that's neat to give it 5 stars twice. You know, I understand what you mean by that.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, that's what's funny about the star ratings too, is it's subjective. Based on how you feel when you read it, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A lot of the time when I reread, it's because I'm reading something I read when I was a teenager or younger, and I know that there's stuff that I missed then, and of course I'm just blown away by how much I did miss, just because I had no experience with whatever the subject might have been.
Yeah,
but it's hard because, like, the other day I went to a Moby Dick party because, you know, Dark November in my soul or whatever the quote is, and so the English department where I work had a party. And there were some people that read their favorite passages from Moby Dick. Now, I have only read Moby Dick one time. And when I finished it, I was like, never again. But hearing some of these passages again, I was like, okay, I definitely didn't appreciate it, you know, when I was in the middle of it. Or maybe I did and I've forgotten and I've put it on this box in my brain. And now I really want to reread it. But then I'm thinking about all these other books. Like, I only made it through halfway through War and Peace this year. And there's too many books.
Too many books to justify.
Yeah. So rereading, something has to be really worthy of it, I think, for me to want to spend the time on it.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. All right, Jean. What's next? All right.
So my second book is also about a girl that has a lover way too quickly in her life. This one's fiction. So I was at the library and I was looking for a book about Eliza Lynch, who was a regent of Paraguay at one point. I was looking for this book for my other book club, the League of Extraordinary Dorks.
And
League of Extraordinary Dorks book club. And I looked down, I couldn't find the book I was looking for, and one shelf down, I noticed this book called The Emperor's Babe, and it's by Bernardine Evaristo. And I thought, what's this about? And I pulled it off the shelf, and the cover is like, it looks like, you know, Cosmo in Roman times. Like, it looks like a Cosmo illustration for Roman beauty products. Like, you know, all the Roman beauty products you need to have now from ancient Rome. And I opened it up and it's in couplets. So it's verse. It doesn't rhyme. And it's, you know, I'm reading The Dust Jacket, and it's about a woman, well, a girl, who is sold by her parents to a senator for his wife. And she's 11 at the time. So it's, the book is about her experience living in Londinium. So in Roman Britain. And it's kind of like, there's a lot of anachronisms and a lot of current London place names, like York and, I don't know, Covent Garden. So it's sort of like, when I started reading it, I thought, this is like third century Bridget Jones, you know, like she has a sassy friend, and she has a sassy, transvestite friend as well. So one friend is more experienced, the other one's just, you know, everybody's all sassy and using current slang. And so I was kind of dismissive of it at first, thinking, oh, okay, you know, it's Bridget Jones goes to Rome. But the further on I got through it, the more profound it became. And I was actually, by the end, really glad that I had picked it up and read it and hadn't just tossed it across the room like I wanted to after the first few pages. So she gets married to a senator named Felix, who's away a lot of the time. And she's, you know, 11. And so it follows her life through when she's 17. And at some point, Septimius Severus, the Roman emperor, comes to Great Britain, and I don't know if you remember Roman history, but he dies at York, spoiler, and she takes him, she becomes his mistress for a brief period of time, and there's lots of descriptions of the poetry readings and also of the feasts that they had and the vomitoriums. And so anyway, she has all these long descriptions of these different events. And as it turns out, the author had spent time as an artist in residence or writer in residence at the Museum of London, where she was learning a lot about the history of not just London, but the presence of the Romans in Great Britain, and how it was a very multicultural and multiracial port city during the early third century. So I read an interview in which she said that she really was trying to kind of take a dig at people who talk about, the good old days when everybody in Great Britain was white, which just wasn't the case. That this Roman emperor was from Libya, North Africa. The main character is her family. They're immigrants from what's now Sudan. And so she was just trying to kind of turn that idea of white England on its head. That, you know, no, there have always been black people in England. Or not always, but, you know, certainly since Rome, mm-hmm. Roman times. Anyway, where am I going with this? So at some point, she gets two Scottish slaves. So that's one of the things that Septimius Severus did, is he invaded what's now Scotland, and didn't have a lot of success there. But, you know, they were still, I guess they're still doing it today, but treating people from Scotland as like savages and wild people. So they, her senator husband got her two matching ginger slaves from Scotland. And so the passage I'm going to read is about her slaves requesting their freedom, or requesting being able to marry instead of just having to be her slaves and live with her. And then also they want their freedom, a common Scottish theme, I guess. So they've been kind of crying to her and asking for their freedom. And she says, they've been such sweet, quiet girls floating around me, never a cross word. Had I got them so wrong? I realized I knew jack shit about them. Zilch, nil, nix, naught, niente, nulla. There was that horror story years ago, all about Boudicca reincarnate and heads on spears. But it was better to dismiss such things. Life began for the girls when we met, and it had been good to them. I needed to go and lie down this day. Really should pass by without me in it. It was Amelia's turn to make a pitch. We miss home so much. Every night we talk about it before we go to Dormio. We picture everyone, hearken their vices. We miss the air, the hills. Accept your fate like everyone else. What we have is all we can hope for. Who was I kidding? I never stop plotting these days. My head feels 1,000 times worse. Bring me the hair of the dog. Remove my makeup. I'm going back to bed. Will you forethink your answer, madam? There's nothing to reconsider, Valeria, and if you continue to pester me, you'll be back in those identity tags. Hold me lest I flee and return me to my master. You will remember the early days. Now stop the bloody whinging. They worked quietly, cleaning my face with oil and cloth, hands gentle and assured, as they'd always been. But what I now felt was pure odium oozing out of every freckled pore in their bodies. I was the person this world had created me to be, and so were they. The who I was becoming, I was not so sure anymore. Our lives were in the hands of the gods, though we could tinker with them, if lucky. If lucky, I will end up far away from here, at my beloved's side. They can come with. I will need them in a strange land. Then and only then can they marry. Of this they will know as and when. One thing I knew for sure. I had suddenly become public enemy numerus primus factum. So, yeah, I mean, there's not a whole lot about with the slang, but there's a lot of Latin thrown in and Italian and other words. So she's at this point in the book realizing that she's a slave as much as they are. But she's trying to make her escape with Septimius Severus. It's just interesting to see these two sides of women being held captive, of women being slaves. And, you know, she takes her slaves for granted, but when they're asking for their freedom, she's starting to see how her life is parallel to their lives. And it's much deeper than I expected it to be. There's way more depth there than you would guess from reading the first part of it, where there's so much of the current London slang and anachronisms.
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting thing. You know, when you started reading it, it kind of hits you, that modern stuff. It's interesting. It's kind of an interesting approach to the story.
Yeah. And I wonder if, you know, having the kind of Cosmo illustration cover and having the slang is just this way of trying to appeal to how shall I say this, a more flippant audience. So, you know, trying to capture the interest of readers who might not otherwise pick it up. Yeah. They might not otherwise seek out a book that was talking about feminism or slavery or injustice.
Mm-hmm.
So can we go back just a second? Because I want to know why you were looking for books about someone, Eliza Lynch.
Eliza Lynch, who was, I'm going to get this wrong, but I can't remember the regent of Paraguay, the king of Paraguay, but it's because of our friend Karen.
Yeah.
You know, and just wanted to learn more about her. Eliza Lynch was an Irish woman who went to Paris as a courtesan. And she kind of hooked up with the king of Paraguay and went back there with him as his mistress. But she wanted to be queen and he wanted her to be queen. And a lot of people were very much against that because she had this bad reputation. And it just sounds like a fascinating story that I want to know more about. And in fact, I've actually checked out 6 books from the library on the subject.
Wow.
I haven't read them yet because I didn't want, you know, I didn't want to forget the 2 books that I was bringing to the podcast today. So tonight, after we're done, I'm totally diving in.
Yeah. But what happy accident that just because that one book wasn't there that you found this other one.
Yeah, exactly.
I love things like that.
Yeah, me too. Books
and stuff.
Nice.
Well, Scott, what's your last one for today? Well,
the last one. First of all, I brought up the Newbery page. The Newbery Medal is just, it said it's awarded annually by the Association for Library Service to Children, a division of the American Library Association. It says to the author of the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children. It doesn't have an age on it. So a Newbery Award winner could be any piece of children's literature, it looks like.
Okay. You know, I think I remember seeing picture books with Newbery seals on the cover. So
yeah. And yeah, it looks, I mean, like, well, you have a medal winner every year and then four honor books. So even the ones that make the short list get a silver medal, it looks like. And then the gold medal goes on the winner. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so there are a lot of Newbery medals on a lot of books. Yeah, pretty cool. Okay, the other one I brought is also a book for kids. I was thinking about some of the books that I've liked, but this book is one that I ran across as an adult. I used to review a lot of audiobooks for sffaudio.com, and one of the books that I got from Blackstone Audio was called A Little History of the World by E.H. Gombrich. Now, E.H. Gombrich, he was born in 1909, died in 2001. He was an Austrian-born art historian. So he wrote this book, A Little History of the World, in German. And it didn't get translated into English until 2005. I'm trying to remember when he wrote it. It was right around... either World War II was going on or had just ended, because the last chapters talk a little bit about World War II. So, so we're talking about 1940s. But I remember I popped it in the player and I was completely captured by the first chapter. And the book is, it's definitely a history of the world written for young readers. But it's very well written. Hopefully it's not too mansplainy, which is a new word in my vocabulary. Because it does, if it has a fault, the fault is that it does read as if an adult is talking to a kid. And I don't know if kids today appreciate that or not, or if that would turn them off. But I'd like to read a little bit so that maybe you guys could have an opinion on that. But I found his writing very poetic, and especially on audio, it was really pleasant to listen to. So that's how I would recommend experiencing it, just because that's how I did it. And each chapter, you know, you could listen to each chapter separately and do that. And, my kids have listened to it, and I think it's really worthwhile. So what I'd like to read is just... from chapter one. It's going to be just about a page long, but he's talking about history and just describing it to a kid. So here we go. All stories begin with once upon a time, and that's just what this story is all about. What happened once upon a time? Once you were so small that even standing on tiptoes, you could barely reach your mother's hand. Do you remember? Your own history might begin like this. Once upon a time there was a small boy, or small girl, and that small boy was me. But before that, you were a baby in a cradle. You won't remember that, but you know it's true. Your father and mother were also small once, and so was your grandfather and your grandmother a much longer time ago. But you know that too. After all, we say, they are old. But they too had grandfathers and grandmothers, and they too could say, once upon a time. And so it goes on, further and further back. Behind every once upon a time, there is always another. Have you ever tried standing between two mirrors? You should. You will see a great long line of shiny mirrors, each one smaller than the one before, stretching away into the distance, getting fainter and fainter, so that you never see the last. But even when you can't see them anymore, the mirrors still go on. They are there, and you know it. And that's how it is with once upon a time. We can't see where it ends. Grandfather's 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 grandfather. It makes your head spin, but say it again slowly, and in the end you'll be able to imagine it. Then add one more. That gets us quickly back into the past, and from there into the distant past. But you will never reach the beginning, because behind every beginning there's always another once upon a time. It's like a bottomless well. Does all this looking down make you dizzy? It does me. So let's light a scrap of paper and drop it down into that well. It will fall slowly, deeper and deeper. And as it burns, it will light up the sides of the well. Can you see it? It's going down and down. Now it's so far down, it's like a tiny star in the dark depths. It's getting smaller and smaller, and now it's gone. Our memory is like that burning scrap of paper. We use it to light up the past. First of all, our own, and then we ask old people to tell us what they remember. After that, we look for letters written by people who are already dead. And in this way, we light our way back. And I'll stop there.
That was lovely.
Isn't that something? Yeah. So, I mean, it works. You know, the first time I heard that, I was like, yeah, man, you know, that just captured me. And I remember a really excellent chapter on Buddhism, one of the clearest explanation on what Buddhism is. I thought that was neat. And it's not so much a dates type of a history of the world. It's kind of a history of the world. Well, you know, it'll have a chapter that talks about the alphabet and how that came about. But I don't remember a lot of, you know, in 1572, this happened. It's not that kind of a thing. It's more of a kind of an overview, some kind of an integrated history. Integrated is not the right word, but I just can't think of the right word. But it's like a, you know, taking a lot of different disciplines and just talking about them is the word I'm trying to come up with. So it's talking about, you know, science and religions and things like that. Wars, you know, so it is hitting the highlights of history. And looking at the chapter headings, about the first, you know, half of it is about the ancient world. So,
was the emperor's babe in there?
The emperor? I don't remember.
With her redheaded slaves?
That's right. There they were, yeah. So was it mansplaining or was it okay?
I thought it was okay. The questions,
mm-hmm.
There's something about them that reminded me a little bit of the way, and this is in the best possible way, a bit about the way Mr. Rogers would speak.
That's right.
That, you know, it's very, because he was always very respectful and very, speaking to a child or a young person right where they were without mansplaining or without mm-hmm. over-explaining like they were stupid, but just, you know, kind of bring questions that would bring them along, bring the viewer along. So I felt that way about the writing. It was just kind of like, kind of the check-in, like, are you with me? Mm-hmm. Let's keep going. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah, I did too. I did too, but it's definitely like an adult speaking to a kid, and my kids were okay with it, but, you know, I just don't know if most kids nowadays would appreciate that kind of writing or not.
It's hard to know.
Sure is worthwhile. You know, it's one of those things, you know, it can give a kid a really nice overview of world history, which would help them in school, you know, at least to have some kind of a foundation. And it's really enjoyable to listen to. So again, I recommend the audiobook. It's very well read.
Did your kids have any particular favorite part?
My daughter did, and it's this first chapter, which she probably listened to, you know, she listened to it over and over, you know, because she thought it was great.
Do you know why? Like,
because of that very thing, the imagery and just the thinking, you know, because now, you know, it's really profound to think about that, you know, and I'm talking about when she was 8, you know, something like that. You know, just to listen to that and then picture that piece of paper falling down the well and then realizing, wow, you know, that's what history is. And eventually you can't see it anymore. You know, again, that imagery just really works. And then, it just opens up your mind to the thought of what it really is that you're talking about. Yeah.
Sounds really good.
Yeah, I like it. And I've mentioned this book on the podcast before, but we never talked about it. I think I mentioned it when we were talking to Brian Alexander once. I can't remember the context, but I know that I brought it up, but I'm glad I got to read some of it and at least give people a flavor of what it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's all I've got.
I like history that doesn't feel like history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it like, kind of sneaks in on you like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Just states. Yep. I had one more little quote I wanted to read from The Far Away Nearby because it felt very appropriate for reading Envy.
Great.
Maybe to end it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's very short. I disappeared into books when I was very young, disappeared into them like someone running into the woods. What surprised and still surprises me is that there was another side to the forest of stories and the solitude, that I came out that other side and met people there.
Hmm.
Aw.
Aw, and there you are.
Yeah.
There you both
there
are.
There you both are, right.
For listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.